Hey there, if you like true crime stories and you love being in the great outdoors, you have come to the right place. Welcome to Crime Off the Grid. Hello, everyone. Awesome that you're listening to another episode of Crime Off the Grid with us. So thanks very much. I'm Tara.
And I'm Nancy.
Well, Nancy and I both had some national park adventures this last week. And we both had these little vacations scheduled to visit some national parks, but not together. So, Nancy, where did you go this last week?
Well, I was in southern Florida. And so my husband and I visited Biscayne National Park.
Oh, yeah.
And we also went to the Dry Tortugas National Park. And then we squeezed in
Big Cypress.
Big Cypress National Preserve.
Because I saw a picture.
Yeah, I was drawing a blank on that one. But yeah, so those three. We were only down there for like 6 days, but we got those three in and had a great time.
Yeah.
How about you?
Well, what was your favorite place down there that you visited? What was the coolest adventure?
The coolest adventure. There were several of them, but one of the coolest is Big Cypress National Preserve is really an amazing place. And, we just had a great time there, stopping at different locations and taking some short hikes out. You know, they have a lot of boardwalks, there above the ground because it's so marshy and everything. And, just really enjoyed going on some hikes there. And we saw a lot of alligators, yeah. And we saw some baby alligators, which was really cool to see out in the wild.
Did you want to hold one and see what mama would do?
Yeah, you know, and I read a sign that says, mama is very aggressive when she has babies. So we definitely kept our distance and did our best to zoom in our phones to take a picture of them. But yeah, it was just really neat to see them out in the wild like that. And then Biscayne National Park, we had to take it's 95% water. So we got on a boat tour and went out to one of the keys. They have a lighthouse out on one of the keys. And so we spent some time out there walking around and going down to the beach. And that was fun to do that. And then always we enjoy the Dry Tortugas. We enjoyed doing a tour out to that park, and it's a fort. And so we had a really good interpretation fella give us a tour of the place. And it was pretty neat.
Cool. Well, that's kind of ironic, though, because we're going to be talking about the area that you just were in our story.
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
Yes, we are. The Everglades, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I went to, with some friends, I went down to the Moab area and visited Arches National Park and Canyonlands. And I'd been to both of those places before, but I was really surprised. Arches, like they have a new system. You have to get an entry time, get a reservation for an entry time. And it was easy to do kind of last minute. And it was not that crowded. And we had a couple of really nice hikes there. And Canyonlands was awesome. And we didn't take long hikes in either one of those parks because they're, main reason we were down there was to do a foot race, the Thelma and Louise race, which I
guess. And you did a half marathon, which is awesome. You did that. So no wonder you didn't take long hikes in those parks.
Well, accidentally, and I'm not going to tell that whole story. I registered for the 15K and accidentally did a half marathon, but okay.
That's amazing.
A funny story about that. But it was perfect weather. It was beautiful. I love the desert down there. I love the BLM areas. I love Canyonlands. I love Arches. It was just a good time to be down there. So
did you guys hike to the arch? The famous arch?
The Delicate Arch.
Delicate Arch, yeah.
Two of us did before our race. And I was like, I'm not doing any kind of hikes the day before I'm doing my what I thought was a 15K race. Okay, I accidentally started with the half marathoners because I had to go to the bathroom and I was in the porta potty and I got all just stressed out and I ran out of the porta potty and the gun goes off and there I go just with the crowd through the start and my brain, it was a half marathon.
And you did great. You and had I a good time good. For your age group.
Not the last one. So who finished? Anyway.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, so today we're going to talk about a case that's much farther back in time than the other cases that we've talked about. And our story takes place in and around the Florida Everglades, where you just were, and near Flamingo, Florida, and Key West. And this is around the late 1800s.
Mm-hmm.
Before there was an Everglades National Park, there was Everglades, the ecosystem. And the ecosystem of Everglades has been around for thousands of years. And water in South Florida once flowed freely from the Kissimmee. Is it? How do you spell? How do you pronounce Kissimmee?
Kissimmee.
Is it Kissimmee or Kissimmee? Yeah.
Well, I suppose it depends on okay. where you're at.
All right. That river to Lake Okeechobee and southward over the low-lying lands to Biscayne Bay, where you just were. In the 10,000 mm-hmm. islands in the Florida Bay. And so this shallow, slow-moving sheet of water covered almost 11,000 square miles, creating a mosaic of ponds, sloughs, sawgrass marshes, hardwood hammock, and forested uplands. And for thousands of years, this intricate system evolved into a finely balanced ecosystem that formed the biological infrastructure for the southern half of Florida. And like you said, in Key Biscayne, you know, it was almost all water, and that's how you saw the park. Mm-hmm. But to early colonial settlers and developers, the Everglades were, you know, they thought, hey, this is potential farmland. And by the early 1900s, they started trying to drain the area, and the drainage process was to transform wetland to land ready to be developed and farmed. Wow. Yeah. And so the results ended up being severely damaging to the ecosystem and all of the species that it supported. And so today, though, thankfully, that's no longer happening. And so life in the town of Flamingo, Florida. Were you in Flamingo at all? Did you go through Flamingo?
No, we were not.
Okay. Well, it's always revolved around basically exploiting what nature offers in the area, which is not unlike, you know, anywhere else. During that time, I know the West, everything's been exploited, you know, hunting and fishing and, mm-hmm. and things. But in the late 1800s, the main ways to earn a living was by hunting and fishing. And in the early 1900s, Flamingo, the town, began to boom thanks to the popularity of the bird plume industry. There were so many bird species in that area of the Everglades, the spoonbills, egrets, and herons, and plume hunters targeted mainly herons, great egrets, and obliterated just about the snowy egret rookeries for their feathers.
So these bird feathers were extremely valuable. So these guys would come in and they would hunt these birds. And there's a guy by the name of Cuthbert, and he was, in terms today, he was a poacher, but it wasn't illegal at that time. But he'd come in and he'd fired and he fired and he fired again his firearms. And once the smoke dissipated, hundreds of birds were dead.
Mm.
Cuthbert, he was pleased with himself because it was hard to make a living down there. Like you just said, there wasn't a lot for people to do other than trap and fish and guide. And so he would paddle towards these floating carcasses and he'd skin them. And then he'd go away, you know, with his catch of the day, just leaving all the carcasses laying on the ground. And then he'd come back for a second trip, and he would succeed in killing nearly all the other birds on the island.
Wow, just wiping them out.
Just wiping them out. And he earned more than $50,000 in today's money.
Oh, my God.
Selling feathers by the ounce. And you got to think about it. An ounce of feathers is not... I mean, you know, it's you got to have a lot of feathers, I would imagine, for an ounce.
Yeah.
So it was said that the feathers would sell for $20 per ounce. And in 2011, that would be equivalent to $500.
Oh, my God.
So at that time, back in the day, it was worth more than gold.
Yeah. There's some incentive. So these,
yeah, definitely an incentive and a way of life, you know, for these people to make money. So these hunters were called plume hunters, P-L-U-M-E hunters. And they were those that killed birds for their feathers. So a plume is a special type of bird feather, and it possessed by egrets, ostriches, birds of paradise, quetzals, pheasants, peacocks, and quails. And I looked up quetzals because I didn't know what kind of bird that was. And it's a really pretty bird. I mean, multiple colors, and it's a smaller bird, but it's very striking. It's very pretty. So in the late 19th century, there were no limits on how many birds a plume hunter could kill, which, you know, for them, that was amazing because they could just go in and do whatever they wanted in the Everglades. So the birds, which lived on an island now called Cuthbert Rookery, they were martyrs to the whims of fashion, and more than 36 different species were killed of birds. So in the late 19th century, there was no fashion-conscious woman in New York or Paris could be seen without a hat that was bedazzled with bird feathers. This was especially true in New York, where new money and socialites wore feathered headwear and ornamented with potpourri and ribbons and jewels and plumes of snowy egrets. So as the way to flaunt their wealth and status, so the more feathers that you had, the more status that you have. And these hats at that time sold for as much as $130 back in the early 1900s.
Wow.
So I know the equivalent of that today is $3,300.
For a stupid hat.
What a hat would cost. For a hat. Mm-hmm. So it's just, you know. And so, you know, these guys are these milleries, you know, they're trying to meet the demand.
Right.
So that industry, which was based in New York, they oversaw the killing of 5 million birds nationwide every year.
Every year.
Yeah. It was a dream job for the rural poor people, such as Cuthbert, and he could easily shoot out an entire rookery. And that is, he could kill all the birds in that area in just a few afternoons. You know, so these guys got to be seeing dollar signs every time, you know, they go out. So with feathers sometimes selling $15 to $20 an ounce, you know, the hunter, they could earn an entire year's salary with just a few pulls of his index finger. With no limits on how many birds a plume hunter could kill, in Cape Cod, 40,000 terns were killed. And a tern, it's a gray and black bird, and it has an orange bill on it. It has a really bright orange bill on it. And again, smaller bird, but very striking. It was a neat bird to look at. They were killed for the hat industry in one summer, 40,000 in one summer. In Florida, the slaughter was often indiscriminate and senseless. So there was a pastime, basically, that, you know, visitors and people that lived there, they would come down on their boats and they would just slaughter these birds. And that was one of their pastimes among tourists visiting the Everglades. It was to shoot the critters from the comfort of their boats.
Yeah.
So, Tara, they didn't just shoot birds. They shot alligators and birds with no intention of ever picking up their carcasses.
Of course. Well, so in Southern Florida, life in the swamps was difficult as far as making a living, and there never did end up being really good land to farm. That didn't really work out. So there was no other major industry as well for people to make money. Besides killing birds, residents would make their money by fishing, fur trapping, harvesting sugarcane, or manufacturing charcoal. I had to look up how you make charcoal. So
I didn't know that either. That was kind of interesting.
So go. I mean, there's different ways, but I was kind of wondering down in South Florida, like what wood did they use to? But there are a lot of different trees that they were using to get the wood to make charcoal. But
Mm-hmm.
So now, among the many people who were killing birds indiscriminately was a man named Guy Bradley. And he was raised on the east coast of Florida, and he spent his teenage years sailing through the mangrove forests of South Florida in search of plumes and discovering the best places to hunt and becoming well acquainted with other hunters across the state. And when Guy was 15 years old, he and his older brother, Louis, served as scouts for a well-known French plume hunter named Jean Chevalier. I don't know if I'm saying this right. blah, 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 blah. On his trip to the Everglades. And on their expedition, which lasted several weeks, the Bradley brothers and the French plume hunters party killed, just on that trip, 1,397 individual birds and 36 different species.
Yeah.
In 1898, the Bradley family moved further south to the Florida's frontier to a sparsely populated backwater town then called Flamingo, which sat not far from the now famed Cuthbert Rookery that you were explaining. And before making the move, the family invited their friend, whose name was Walter Smith, to join them. Smith was this old aging Confederate sharpshooter, and he said, yeah, I'll come move with you. But then later, things with Guy Bradley and Walter Smith would become strained, so put a pin in that. In 1899, Guy married a young widow who goes by Froni, F-R-O-N-I-E, and she was from Key West.
Yeah, he moved down there, you're right, and he helped guide people until it became illegal to do so. And the conservation movement came in Florida. I mean, people are like, something's got to be done here. These birds are all going to be extinct. So Audubon societies, they started popping up all over. And the Audubon Society, the first major bird protection society, which was named after John James Audubon. In 1886, George Bird Grinnell, a conservationist and editor of Forest and Stream, formed the first major bird protection society, which he named after John James Audubon. The ornithologist and painter who published the groundbreaking book, The Birds of America. Within a decade, independent Audubon societies would pop up across the northeastern United States, claiming supporters as prominent as the New York governor, Theodore Roosevelt. The object of this organization is to be a barrier between wild birds and animals and a very large unthinking class and a smaller but more harmful class of selfish people. So a gentleman by the name of William Dutcher, he was a businessman and an ornithologist who became the National Audubon Society's first president. So Dutcher knew exactly who he was matched up against because the millinery industry, they employed 83,000 people. And it was worth, back then, $17 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So Florida Governor Jennings, with the help from the Florida Audubon Society, instituted a ban on plume hunting in 1900. But Dutcher had friends in high places, and he believed he could convince politicians to pass legislation that could save America's birds from extinction. He had a key lobbyist helping pass the Lacey Act, which made it a federal crime to poach birds in one state and sell them in another.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1901, he traveled to Tallahassee and successfully lobbied the Florida state government to pass a law protecting plume birds with the help of State Senator William Hunt Harris of Monroe County, an act for the protection of birds and their nests and eggs, and prescribing a penalty for the violation thereof was passed, barring any person in Florida from killing plume birds or selling their feathers. So Tara, you know, it's one thing to pass a law. It's another thing to enforce it.
Oh, yeah.
So most plume hunters lived in remote areas, hundreds of miles away from the closest newspaper or courthouse. And Dutcher knew that if the new law was going to be remotely meaningful, he needed a warden who could enforce it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody who knew his way around Florida's rookeries, who knew the tricks of plume trade and who knew plume hunters themselves. So this is the man we are talking about in this story today. So he hired Guy Bradley, at this time a reformed plume hunter who had given up the profession after the passage of the Lacey Act in 1900. So as you talked about earlier, as a boy, you know, he often served as a guide to visiting fishermen and plume hunters, although he later denounced poaching after the legislation was passed to protect the dwindling number of birds. In 1902, Bradley was hired by the American Ornithologist Union to become one of the country's first game wardens. So he became not only a game warden, but also a deputy sheriff, which gave him the authority to arrest those hunting illegally. Mm-hmm. He was an American game warden and deputy sheriff for Monroe County, Florida, which is in southern Florida. So I'll describe what Bradley's job was. He was responsible for reporting suspected poachers and the businesses with which they worked. He was paid a monthly stipend of $35.
Yes, not $50,000 for killing bird feathers. That's
no.
Yeah.
No, and I think, what is that, like less than $1,000 a year?
Yeah, yeah.
And he single-handedly patrolled the enormous area stretching from 10,000 islands on the Florida's west coast through the Everglades to Key West, which served as nesting areas for popular plume birds such as egrets, herons, spoonbills, and ibis. Bradley took his job very seriously. He educated locals about the newly implemented laws, which made plume hunting a punishable offense. He spoke to hunters directly. He posted warning signs throughout his territory. He issued citations and arrested violators of the new plum band. And this is, he didn't arrest people just because he came upon them. He gave them multiple chances.
Right.
You know, he educated, the lowest level of law enforcement, he educated. And if they didn't get it, then an arrest came after that. He also set up a network of spies who watched for suspicious behavior. And he employed his brother Lewis and others close to him to work as assistant wardens during the height of the plume season. Mm-hmm. Well, with this new law enforcement, he became hated and watched by local hunters. He had no reinforcements. He was shot at more than once. And after accepting the position as game warden, Bradley became a vilified figure in South Florida. And it's crazy. He working alone, you know, no backup, nobody to really help him. And in 1904, Bradley alerted visiting ornithologist and author Frank Chapman that one of the more isolated rookeries called Cuthbert had been shot out, despite previously having been found to be in good condition. He reportedly said, "You could have walked right around the rookery on those birds' bodies." Between 400 and 500 of them
disgusting.
Laid there.
Disgusting.
That is this just made me mad reading.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of painful.
Yeah, it was.
Well, you know, I said earlier, the relationship with Guy Bradley and Walter Smith became strained, and that was initially over a land dispute between Smith and someone named Roberts, a neighbor, where Guy happened to be also the surveyor, and he had sided with Roberts in that land dispute. So that strained his relationship with Walter Smith. And then the tensions that would eventually boil over into Guy's work as the game warden, Smith, like many people in Flamingo, continued to supplement their income by hunting plumes. And he just deliberately broke the law around Guy, like he had zero respect for him right in front of him. And by late 1904, Guy had arrested and fined old man Smith once. So he's like, you know, he's not listening. I'm fining you. Then he arrested him. And then he also arrested Smith's eldest teenage son, Tom. And that really ticked off Walter. So when Guy arrested his son, Tom, a second time, Smith told him, "You ever arrest one of my boys again, I'll kill you." Early in the morning on July 8th, 1905, Guy had left for the Oyster Keys. And now it was well past supper and his boat was nowhere to be seen. So Franny, his wife, became very worried. And when Guy failed to appear the following morning, she called on her neighbor, Gene Roberts, and asked him to please go search for her husband. And it was raining at that time, but Roberts, he didn't mind. He set off on his sailboat and headed toward the Keys. So he was peering through the gray drizzle. He couldn't see a boat or anything. So he continued to sail westward with the current toward the nearby village of Sawfish Hole. And near the water's edge, he noticed an empty dinghy just bobbing in the water. And he immediately recognized it as Guy's boat. So as he gets closer, he saw splayed at the bottom of the boat was Guy Bradley's body. There was a gaping red gunshot wound just festered by his collarbone. And there was a .32 caliber pistol that was laying near one of his hands. And Roberts looked at the weapon and determined that it was Guy's pistol and it had not been fired. Meanwhile, around the time Roberts made this discovery, his neighbor, Walter Smith, was 70 miles south in Key West, and he was tying up his boat, and he walked straight to the Monroe County Sheriff, Frank Knight, and said, quote, "I've shot Guy Bradley," end quote. He later explained that the reason had something to do with bird feathers. Yeah, no duh.
Exactly.
What happened was, when Walter Smith saw Bradley approaching, he fired a warning shot into the clouds, signaling his boys, who were somewhere on the island shooting at the birds, signaling to his boys to return to the schooner. And Bradley watched as the boys carried the bodies of two dead cormorants back to the boat. Tom Smith turned toward the rookery and fired his rifle into the nest like a big bird with a finger to Guy. And these people were just flaunting their illegal actions off and killing these plume birds. And it sounded like that normally if Guy ran into plume hunters, like you said, he preferred to talk to them and maybe convince them to stop, but not the Smith boys. They knew better and they just did it anyway, right in front of him.
Right. And they'd already been arrested. So the education had already been there.
Yeah. And Smith says, quote, "You're one of those fellas who shot into my house and I'll not put down my gun when you're near me. If you want him," meaning his son Tom, "you have to come aboard this boat and take him." And at this, Bradley clutched his pistol and Smith pointed his rifle right at Guy. Guy says, "Put down that rifle and I will come aboard." What happened next is unclear, but Smith would later say that Bradley never knew what hit him. So in Key West, the sheriff charged Smith with murder and set the bail at $5,000. When word of Bradley's death reached the Audubon Society, everybody assumed justice would prevail. Smith, after all, had openly admitted to killing a law enforcement officer. Senator William H. Harris, the same politician who helped push the bird law through the Florida legislature, was slated as the prosecutor. So that all sounded like it was going to go in the favor of the state against Smith. Well, the case attracted the attention of newspapers across the country. A group of rook killers concerned in the secret traffic of bird plumage shot him in order to kill as many birds as they like, end quote, reported the Los Angeles Herald. The newspapers reported, "Smith, it is pleasant to note, will suffer the penalty of the Florida law." The reporters didn't appear to know that Walter Smith had spent the past decade building political connections in Monroe County, where friends were encouraging him to open his purse strings and pay as much as possible for a lawyer who could reduce his prison sentence. And he was not well-liked at all where he lived in Flamingo, but he really did try to mix and mingle with the hoity-toities in Monroe County. Well, of course, he had a defense attorney. And what do you think he claimed for his defense? What was his argument?
Yeah. Self-defense,
even back then. Oh, it was self-defense. Yes. He said the warden had fired first. Okay, again, that self-defense against a law enforcement officer, that's not a thing. This reminds me of the Claude Dallas episode that we did on Crime Off the Grid several weeks ago, where those game wardens come across this well-known poacher. And so the poacher kills two officers and he says, "Oh, self-defense. That's not a thing. You don't get to shoot at the cop and say self-defense."
No, you don't.
Yeah. But those who knew Bradley actually insisted he was a good shot. And if he had really shot his weapon, there's no way he was going to miss Smith. And he mm-hmm. would not have missed his target if he had in fact shot first. Smith was later found not guilty of murder.
So the interesting part that I thought about that, Tara, was that the guy that found Bradley's body noticed that the gun had not been fired. Right. So I'm not sure how the self-defense theory came into play when he never even fired a shot. And the prosecutor never even brought him in as a witness or right. to testify right. to that fact.
That's yeah. right. So had that come out, maybe there had been a different outcome because people were saying that there was some incompetence with the prosecution in this trial. And I would say, yeah, that's probably very likely. So Smith had served 5 months in jail, but that was from the time he was arrested and awaiting trial. And after he was acquitted, of course, he got out and he never even paid the $5,000 for bail. So while Smith was incarcerated those 5 months, though, Bradley's two brothers-in-law burned down Smith's flamingo home. So
nice.
Yeah. I mean, it's...
Two wrongs don't make right, but come right. on.
We don't want to do vigilante justice here, but you know, I got to say, I don't have a problem with that. Bradley's death and Smith's acquittal again made national headlines, and these stories ran in the New York Times and New York Herald and the Philadelphia North American and Forest and Stream. And Froney, his wife, Guy's wife, and their two young children were given a home in Key West, paid for donations secured by the Florida Audubon Society. And that was nice that they actually did something to take care of his family.
Yeah, that was really nice that they did that.
So Bradley's obituary was written by William Dutcher and then published in August 1905's edition of Bird Lore. And they characterized him as, quote, fearless and brave. And Dutcher eulogized Bradley by saying, quote, a faithful and devoted warden who was a young and sturdy man cut off in a moment for what? That a few more plume birds might be secured to adorn heartless women's bonnets. Heretofore, the price has been the life of the birds. Now is added human blood. Every great movement must have its martyrs, and Guy M. Bradley is the first martyr in bird protection.
So after Guy was killed, with no one to replace him, lawlessness continued in the Everglades, and the rookeries were devastated for several more years. So Frank Chapman remarked that there is no community sufficiently law-abiding that you could leave a bank vault unmolested if it were left unprotected. We have given up, we can't protect it, and the rookery will have to go. That's really sad.
That is so sad.
So now that the lawlessness has returned, in November 1908, they hired another game warden and deputy sheriff of DeSoto County, and his name was Columbus McLeod, and he went missing near Charlotte Harbor. A month later, his boat was found weighted down and sunk. And inside, police found the warden's blood-stained hat. And Tara, it had long gashes cut into the crown with what appeared to be an axe.
Oh my gosh!
It was suspected that he was killed by poachers. His body was never found, and the perpetrators were never caught. You know, I mean, you can dump a body in that swamp, and them alligators would make short order of it. I mean, no wonder they don't, you know, find bodies down there.
Well, right. Well, when I was just down there last November with my friend and we're driving through, well, we were going through Big Cypress and all of the alligators, and we're like, that's where I'd dump a body right there. And we'd go down a little bit longer. I'm like, that's where I'd dump a body.
That is funny because I said the same thing to Dwayne when we were driving through there. I said, man, you could dump a body there and nobody'd ever find it.
And I'm sure there's plenty of, maybe that's where the rainbow people got their skulls, was they went fishing for skulls in the swamp. Remember Could when be. You said the rainbow people and their skulls? Yep.
Anyway. So despite the offer of a $100 reward by Florida's governor, so still never caught him, still never found the body. Later that year, an employee of the South Carolina Audubon Society, Presley Reeves, was also shot and killed during an ambush by unknown assailants. And no arrests were ever made in that one also. So now you've got two game wardens and an Audubon Society employee that was shot and killed. So finally, the end of the stupid hats.
Thankfully.
Came.
Yeah.
So Congress banned the feathered hats so that the fashion craze could end. And the Audubon Society shifted their focus from stopping poachers to stopping the millinery industry in New York. And in 1910, Audubon lobbyists convinced New York state lawmakers to pass a bill forbidding the importation of plumes. That was followed by the Weeks-McLean Act in 1913, which banned the importation of wild bird feathers, and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act of 1918, which made it illegal to sell or transport hundreds of species of birds. So by 1920, film stars everywhere were flaunting short haircuts. And this started, I can't remember the actress, but she had cancer and ended up shaving her head or cutting her hair really short. And so when the other actresses saw the short hair, they kind of followed suit. It kind of became a thing to have short haircuts.
I kind of remember seeing those pictures, I guess.
Yeah. So that made the extravagant feather-loaded hats look and feel awkward.
Hmm.
And so by the roaring 20s, the plum business, like its victims, was dead.
Good.
So some good things came. You know, you never want to see anybody lose their life.
Right.
But, you know, Guy Bradley, he left a legacy. And even though he was shot and killed by a poacher at age 35, his much-publicized death had galvanized conservationists and served as the inspiration for future legislation to protect Florida's bird populations. So several national awards and places have been named in his honor. So let me tell you about a few of them. So in 1910, the New York legislature passed the Audubon Plumage Act, outlawing the plume trade. Other states followed, and Congress soon banned the import of hats decorated with bird feathers. Faithful unto death, as game warden of Monroe County, he gave his life for the cause to which he had pledged. At the Flamingo Visitor Center, a plaque was dedicated to Bradley's memory, and it reads, "Audubon Warden was shot and killed off this shore by outlaw feather hunters, July 8th, 1905. His martyrdom created nationwide indignation, strengthened bird protection laws, and helped bring Everglades National Park into existence."
Excellent.
That is very excellent. In 1988, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation established the Guy Bradley Award to recognize achievements in wildlife law enforcement. The award is presented annually to two recipients, one state and one federal officer. Another honor, the Guy Bradley Lifetime Conservation Award, was established in 1997 by the Audubon Society Everglades Ecosystem Restoration Campaign to those who promote conservation and offer workable conservation solutions. A trail in Everglades National Park, leading from the Flamingo Visitor Center to the Flamingo Campground, was also named in Bradley's honor. And this is kind of cool. After a renovation, the Flamingo Visitor Center was renamed the Guy Bradley Visitor Center. Mm-hmm. So this is, I mean, this is a long time. You know, you're talking from 1905 to 1988. And all this stuff, and 1997,
right,
when they redid the visitor center. So I think that's pretty cool that
he's still being remembered.
Yeah.
I thought this was a interesting story to read about because, you know, you don't always think about these things that we kind of take for granted, some of these protections for our wildlife and birds and lands and other environmental protections. We don't ever necessarily know why we even have them. And I think this was a really interesting story.
I thought it was really, when I started researching some of this and what, you know, went on, like I said earlier, it just made me sick to read about all the wildlife, the birds especially, that were killed, you know, for these feathers and for the hats. But yeah, I agree with you. It's, you know, to have these laws in the place. There's a good reason for it.
Right. All right. Well, if you haven't already, please follow us on Instagram and Facebook and share with your friends. We'd appreciate that. So we'll just end it here. Stay safe in wild places and watch out for the company you keep.
And if you see something, say something.